Welcome back to More Than Money. We're continuing our conversation with Connor McFarland about the private debt markets. And I think that was an interesting teaser. And we're going to get to the why should the average retail investor care about this in a minute. But there's some things I think that people still need to be educated about to understand the opportunity set, risks, and returns.
Yeah, you got it, Dave. And I think we have a lot of conversations with our clients about, you know, going through their retirement planning and you know, net worth, mm-hmm. right? And some of that net worth is, we call it liquid and not liquid, yeah. right? Because you can have assets that are not liquid, like a house, it's right. not as liquid. You can't sell it every day. So Connor, maybe you can kind of give us a little bit of insight on the liquidity of, you know, the private market, and how it relates to an individual investor.
Sure. So I think there's a wide spectrum here. So obviously a stock or a bond, you know, those are liquid assets that you can sell within a day, essentially. The other side of that spectrum, there are some institutional funds that are out there, maybe on the private equity side, where you can't touch your money for 7 to 10 years. The products that we're talking about, which we think fit within an advisor's portfolio, are those that kind of fall in the middle, where generally these funds will offer quarterly liquidity. And so those investors that want to redeem some of their money, they would be able to receive that capital back within a given quarter, subject to the potential for some of that capital staying within the fund to ensure that assets wouldn't have to be sold at prices that those managers don't want to sell at.
Okay. Yeah. So liquidity, I think that's an important piece of the overall planning and your exposure, right? Make sure that you know, that it's appropriate for you. Now let's go back to the purpose of it. Why would somebody want this? I mean, one of the things that you said that caught my interest in the last segment, of course, is that we can get a yield premium over what you can get in the public markets. We're cutting out that middleman, right? So the investor essentially gets to grab that. So from an income perspective, maybe we can talk about this strategy and how it would relate to a person moving into retirement and their need for income.
Sure. And I think anyone who's looking to buy into the credit universe is looking for the income component to take that cash and use it to, you know, for whatever reason they need. And I would say private credit specifically is an area of the investment universe that provides arguably one of the highest income distributions in the market. And so it depends on the fund, it depends on the market environment, but today we're seeing income distributions kind of in the high single digits territory that goes directly into the hands of investors on a monthly basis.
Now, Connor, it's not just about income, because what I think, I mean, never mind the private credit markets, bonds generally aren't well understood by the average investor. And so again, depending on the environment, interest rates going up and down, there's also the potential to have capital growth on this. So it's not just income, but there's a potential capital growth story. Maybe tell us about how that works and how that happens.
Yeah, sure. So you might give out a loan that maybe is not priced at $100. It might be priced at $98. And when that loan is paid back, it could then price back at $100. And so it's not just, you know, the 8 or 10 or 11% coupon that you're receiving. You're also receiving potentially an additional return pickup in addition to that income distribution. So even though funds will quote an income distribution, for example, at 8%, there's the potential for some additional return premium over and above that level.
And maybe the last point, just to clarify, is when you get that capital growth on a bond, it's again taxed as capital gain, not as interest income. So there's some tax advantages to that too. And make sure you get proper tax advice to fully understand it. Let's talk about the private credit market. So, and just tell us a little bit about what you're seeing. What are the trends right now?
Sure. I would say one of the main trends we alluded to earlier is that this is an exploding asset class, and it's here to stay. You've seen trillions of dollars pulled out of the public space into the private space. And so it's becoming an investment universe that is too large to ignore for many investors. I think 10 years ago, it's easy to ignore an area that is growing and very small. But now if you ignore the private credit space, you're no longer having access to the entire universe of credit instruments that are being offered. I think another trend that we would expect to see is a growth in other parts of the private credit universe outside of just corporate direct lending. As investors are looking at their public credit allocations, they want to have a diverse exposure. They don't want to just buy investment grade bonds. They want to buy leveraged loans. They want to buy securitized products, government bonds. We would take the same philosophy on the private side. It doesn't make sense just to invest in corporate direct lending. it makes sense to expand that universe into every corner of the private credit universe. And we think that's the direction of travel for the industry.
What happens in the event if we're direct lending to a business and the business doesn't pay us back? How does an investor, how are they compensated? How are they rewarded? How are they protected against that potential outcome?
Sure. So I think this is another unique aspect about the private credit markets. There are a lot of tools at the disposal of direct lenders that maybe on the public side you would not have. One example of this is because it's a bilateral agreement, you know, just you and I, Dave, maybe I'm lending to you, you're borrowing from me. We are able to sit down at the table. And as a lender, we might say, hey, I might not be able to make this coupon payment. You might say, hey, that's okay. We'll give you another month. We'll give you another quarter. We'll be able to work this out. Potentially, we can extend the maturity of this loan. The problem with the public market is that you have hundreds of participants in this bond. And so you can't just sit at the table and have this cordial conversation. There's going to be a lot of infighting. There's going to be a lot of scrapping to try to maximize your returns at the expense of other investors. And so we would say, there's the potential for greater downside protection in some of these more workout scenarios.
I think that's an interesting point you just made. You can maybe give us just a quick review, because I know you touched on it, on why companies are going to that private market as well.
Sure. So if you go to the public markets, you go through the bank process,
yep.
You have to get that loan rated. You have to go to a ratings agency. You have to pay for that. It takes about 3 months for you to do a roadshow and find a bunch of investors. If you go to the direct lending market, you can just call up your friend and they will give you the loan within 2 weeks, potentially. You don't have to get it rated. And it's, again, all of the benefit from you being able to negotiate. If maybe you're not able to make a payment, the borrower is not able to make a payment, you can kind of work out that loan to the benefit of both the borrower and the lender. So there's a host of benefits as a company that's looking to borrow in either public or private markets. They typically would prefer to choose private. Of course, the downside there is that usually you have to pay a higher coupon in that market, which again is why investors like that.
And I think it's important to note that Connor used the example, you know, you and I are lending back and or whatever, I'm lending, you're borrowing. It's not that, right? This is amongst hundreds and hundreds of businesses. So this is a diversified risk. And I think it's important that people understand that the way you can control risk, there's a number of ways, but one of which is you have position sizing and you're not overly exposed to one. And I think that's why it's important to do this through a fund, an exchange traded fund, a liquid alternative, whatever the case may, whatever the structure is as an individual, you got to make sure you've got that diversification there. Okay, we've got to wrap this up. I think this has been fantastic. And thank you, Connor, for shedding some light on what is a new market for people. And I think making it understandable as to where it would fit and how would you want to think about this in the context of an overall portfolio. We've got to put it in, I've got to make sense of this and the whole retirement experience at our next seminar.
You got it, Dave. Our next one is in Calgary on Tuesday, October 29th, 7 p.m. in person at the Hamptons Golf and Country Club. Go to morethanmoneyradio.com or connect with us on Facebook to register.
Okay, Connor McFarland, CFA Vice President and Alternative Strategist at PIMCO. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Rob.
You know, Rob, when you take these last couple of segments with Connor and we think about where it should fit in a portfolio or how does somebody build that into their strategy, what should they be thinking about?
Well, I think about, first we talked about liquidity,
yeah,
right, in that. So how does it fit into your total portfolio and where there's liquidity in a portfolio?
Yeah.
The way that, you know, we look at portfolios is looking at it as more of a pillar strength. So maybe we right. should just kind of talk about what those pillars actually are.
Yeah. So, I think that's probably a good definition. There's sort of five pillars that make up what we consider a good portfolio. The first three would be traditional asset classes, right?
Right.
So cash we start with.
Yep.
Canadian stocks and then international stocks.
You got it. You get your alternative space.
Right.
Right. So that's where this will fit in. Alternative trading, alternative yield.
Right.
This would be more of an alternative yield piece.
Yeah, agreed. And fixed income would sort of
fixed income.
Right. Yeah, finalize those five different pillars. But you know, when you put a portfolio together, of course you have to match what your risk objectives are and what your growth goals are and you know, all of those different things for sure. And so when you think that through and then you start applying the five pillars to build out that portfolio, you know, if you just think about a typical structure, if it has one pillar wobbling around, two, three becomes more secure, right? Four, five pillars, you've got a really, really strong foundational base. And so I think it's important whether you pursue alternative credit or alternative investments at all, You just think about the proper composition of the portfolio given those goals and objectives, right? Great. Is investing in cash killing your retirement? Stick around after the break to find out. You're on QR Calgary and More Than Money.